Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. In the news this week, a deadly shooting at a high school in Florida. 17 dead. Student David Hogg said it's time to stop the madness.
Please, this is the 18th one this year. That's unacceptable. We're children. You guys are the adults. You need to take some action and play a role. Work together, come over your politics, and get something done.
Tuesday, Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats warned the 2018 elections are already under attack by Russia.
Frankly, the United States is under attack. Under attack by entities that are using cyber to penetrate virtually every major action that takes place in the United States.
And a fresh start for South Africa. President Jacob Zuma bowed to the pressure to step aside.
I have therefore come to the decision to resign as President of the Republic with immediate effect.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Lisa Desjardins, Michael Crowley, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. Were you satisfied by President Trump's response to the Florida shooting? Are you frustrated yet again by a stalemate on immigration? Join us at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me this hour from Arlington, Virginia, Lisa Desjardins, correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Lisa, wonderful to have you.
Hi, Jane. Great to be here.
Thank you. And from Washington, Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Michael, great to have you.
Hi, Jane. So glad to be here.
Thank you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. As always, welcome, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Lisa, and Michael.
So we'll start with the school shootings in Florida. The 19-year-old shooter, a troubled young man armed with an AR-15 semi-automatic weapon, which he purchased legally, killed 17 people, many others injured. Here's a vigil held in Parkland, Florida last night where Fred Gutenberg, whose 14-year-old daughter Jamie was killed, spoke publicly about how he and his wife are struggling to cope with their loss.
I don't know what I do next. My wife is home. We are broken. But I can tell you, don't tell me there's no such thing as gun violence. It happened in Parkland.
In his response to what happened this week in Parkland, President Trump spoke directly to students to remind them that even in dark times like these, they are not alone.
Especially those who feel lost, alone, confused, or even scared. I want you to know that you are never alone and you never will be. You have people who care about you, who love you, and who will do anything at all to protect you.
Michael Crowley, here we are again, another school shooting. What struck you this week as you watched this unfold?
Well, I wish I had something more novel to say than what struck me was the incredible, tragic helplessness that so many Americans are feeling, that this happens over and over again, and we go through the same cycle of shock and horror and outpourings of grief. And then immediately our political system snaps into predictable patterns where liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans fall on their back into their battle trenches. And there's very little sign that things will change. And it's difficult to come up with, you know, a novel way of looking at the situation that wasn't apparent to us several massacres ago. you know, including the Newtown massacre, where the children were so much younger, and I believe the death toll was significantly higher. So we have a national crisis of sorts on our hands. I wish I could tell listeners that I saw some reason to think this is the turning point. This is the one that's going to lead to some sort of breakthrough in social or government action that will prevent the next one. But I just really don't see it. You know, you wonder if there is a tipping point, if finally, you know, one of these horrific events will be either in, you know, in its scale or its details will change the public consciousness, or there's just some scale that tilts eventually when we've had just too many and the politics of this country change. But I don't see any prospect for meaningful national response to this horrific tragedy.
Lisa Desjardins, President Trump made a 6-minute speech yesterday about the shooting. He did not mention guns or gun laws. Instead, he talked about better protections for schools. He talked about mental health services. What do you see in all this? What did you hear in the president's statements?
Right. And I think that is the repeated pattern, almost the script. I think you can say that Michael was just talking about what stood out to me in the president's remarks, not only that he didn't utter the word gun, but that this is a president who in 2000, when in one of his books, wrote that he himself would support a ban on assault weapons. Now, fast forward to now, and we have that's not even part of the conversation on the Republican side. I think what struck me in the past few days was the level of denial in Congress over where we are right now. And that was on a couple of fronts. When the shooting, when we were getting word of just how deadly this shooting was, I was standing outside of the House chamber, and I, you know, was reporting on all the immigration back and forth in both chambers. And, you know, it was just gut-wrenching. I felt like how I know I need to cover this immigration law. I know how important it is, but I was emotionally so focused on what was happening in Florida. And at the same time, members of Congress from both parties were coming up to me and saying, hey, what are you covering? What's going on? Almost as if it wasn't on their radar. You know, it was sort of like I was in a different world than they were. Now, it's possible they just didn't really realize how bad things were at that moment, but this was many hours into it. The next day, yesterday, things were different. Obviously, there was more of an acceptance of this tragedy and recognition of it. However, when I talked to members of Congress from both parties, Jane, you know, they gave me the same general lines with no specifics of how you react. I asked Speaker Ryan in his news conference, is now the time for a special committee on this, whatever you call it? You don't need to call it gun violence if that's too sensitive for Republicans, but is this time for a special committee on this issue? He responded, hey, we passed a law on mental health, again, pointing to that. And he's right. They did 2 years ago. And we want to see what that does. What he didn't say, Jane, was that that law on mental health was extremely watered down. It does not do very much to significantly address the mental health problems in this country, nor address connecting those who are identified with mental health problems with the background check system. So, again, it just the level of denial from our lawmakers is what really got to me.
You mentioned the mental health. Ironically, the Associated Press reported today that when the president talks about these debates in terms of mental health issues, and that's really where the focus should be, the president, AP reported, is actually cutting mental health services in his proposed budget. Jack Beatty, are we running in circles here?
Well, it that is the pattern, isn't it? But, you know, Michael talks about looking at the scale that tilts, not seeing it. Well, there are two scales approaching. There are two elections can decide whether we have gun control, whether we ban assault weapons, whether we have background checks, whether we have the whole panoply of reforms that have been suggested over the years, the congressional election and the coming presidential election. This is a party matter now. It was not in the past with rural state Democrats. As you know, in 2005, I believe it was, a clutch of Democrats voted to immunize the gun manufacturers against suits, Bernie Sanders included. the people that and then there were Democrats who voted who wouldn't go along with President Obama's gun control measure. But there's only one of those left now in the Senate, Heidi Heitkamp. And this is a party matter. The GOP is bought and sold by the NRA. You can see it in Marco Rubio, who came out with pious statements about, oh, we need to, this may not be the time, and, you know, the human condition is full of tragedy, and who was paid $3,303,355 by the NRA. He's an employee of the NRA, as are the Republicans. An election can decide, two elections can decide whether this absurd pattern will go on. There is a straight party difference. If you want gun control, vote the GOP Congress out and vote Mr. Trump out.
Let me get David in here from Hartsfield, Tennessee. Hi, David. Welcome to On Point.
Hey.
Hi.
Hello. I would like to make a comment that hasn't been brought up. Migratory birds, ducks, doves, geese, can be hunted with a gun with a maximum capacity of 3 shells. And it has to be manually reloaded. We need to get a perspective on people versus migratory birds. It's just ridiculous that this hasn't been brought into the discussion.
David, thank you. Lisa Desjardins, jump back in here.
Well, I think there is a very large discussion here that we haven't gotten to about the specifics of how gun laws work and why they do. And obviously, this is one specific sporting law about one particular species and migratory birds. But I think there is a big point here that the shooter in this case was 18 years old, we believe, when he purchased this gun a year ago. And an 18-year-old is able to purchase an AR-15, not able to purchase other weapons like handguns. You know, so we have to look at these conflicts in our laws that are really just kind of willy-nilly on some level.
Michael Crowley, a White House official this week said the president has a, quote, strong interest in background checks. I'm just curious, would a background check on this Florida shooter have mattered with no criminal history? I mean, clearly somewhat troubled, but would that have even been effective? Is that realistic?
Well, it depends on how you design the background check. And, you know, again, there's this grim weariness when you have these conversations, because I feel like I've opined on the same question before. You know, this is very complicated. You could design a background check that tried to capture mental health history, but that wades into medical privacy. Is not an easy solution. So there are background checks that are superficial. There are background checks that are very deep. Where's the line where it becomes invasive and potentially unfair? And that is a really hard political question, especially in this climate. So I don't think that that's a silver. I don't want to use that metaphor. I don't think that's an easy solution.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
You've probably heard about this Russia investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Every day there's a new headline about it. Well, Embedded is back with 2 episodes that lay the whole thing out, start to finish, so the news makes sense. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the week's top stories, and you can join us. What did you hear in the CIA chief's warning about Russia and meddling in our next election? Do you wish you could have been a fly on the wall when Steve Bannon spoke to Special Counsel Bob Mueller this week? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest this hour, Lisa Desjardins from the PBS NewsHour, Michael Crowley from Politico, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. I wanted to get this in here, speaking on the Senate floor on Wednesday, Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut said the failure of lawmakers to take decisive action is allowing mass shootings to continue across the country.
It only happens here not because of coincidence, not because of bad luck, but as a consequence of our inaction, we are responsible for a level of mass atrocity that happens in this country with zero parallel anywhere else.
Senator Murphy, of course, has been an outspoken supporter of gun control legislation for years, representing the state where Sandy Hook is, Sandy Hook Elementary, where the shooting occurred in 2012. 26 children and adults killed at Sandy Hook. A couple of callers on this point. Joe in Akron, Ohio, first. Hi, Joe. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. I could echo the senator's sentiment right there. 26, 27 people in Sandy Hook happened, and I remember thinking clearly and cynically at the time, if this doesn't get them to act, nothing will. And here we are almost 5 years later, and how many school shootings, mass shootings later, horrific acts where you have multiple people dead, and nothing has happened. I'm sorry to be so dark like this, but that's exactly the situation. Of all the shootings that have happened since then, this is another one.
Joe, thank you. In fact, 18 school shootings just this year. Carl in Tampa, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Jen. How are you? I'll try and make this quick.
Sure.
I said look at a three-pronged approach, which we've already started. Put pressure on our politicians out of ballot box. Two, we look at security. And three, which I've not heard, we make it not cool to have a gun, to own a gun, similar to the campaign we did for cigarette smoking. And I listened to your comments off here, but we make it not cool to even be around anybody with a gun.
Carl, thank you. Thanks very much. Obviously, more to come on this as we listen to the debates, the discussion. We move forward. Let's go to immigration now. Here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer speaking on the Senate floor yesterday, talking about it's disappointing that a bipartisan immigration bill failed to pass the Senate. Here he is.
We've waited a long time and worked very hard for the chance to vote on a bill to protect Dreamers. I regret that the only bipartisan effort of the group of moderate senators to come up with a bipartisan compromise couldn't get the necessary 60 votes.
And here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell saying the immigration proposal put forth by President Trump was a fair compromise.
I thought our friends across the aisle would jump at this opportunity to fulfill what they say is their top priority. But they just couldn't take yes for an answer. They turned away from a golden opportunity to solve the issue.
Lisa Desjardins, Congress started the week with a promise of an open debate on immigration, and now here we are, right back where we started. Help us understand what was supposed to happen and what didn't happen.
You know, I'm still unpacking exactly what's going on here, but I the bottom line is that we saw a complete breakdown in the Senate's ability to function. And the reason I say that, now, it's obviously possible for a functioning Senate to not pass a bill, to not come up with a solution. But this is an issue on which most Americans agree. This should be an easy one. Most Americans feel that Dreamers should have some kind of status, those brought here illegally as kids. And most Americans also agree that we need to increase border security. Now, those were the two ideas on the table here. But for a number of political reasons, largely including the president, none of the ideas were able to pass yesterday. As the bipartisan group of senators came out with their plan on Wednesday night, this was the one plan that was thought could get 60 votes. Within an hour, I and other reporters received a very remarkable email from the Department of Homeland Security in some of the sharpest language I've ever seen, saying that this bill was a threat to security. And they were talking about one particular provision. I won't want to get too far into the weeds on that, but there was a lot of misunderstanding over it and a lot of questions about it still. But the language they used is the point. The next day, the president came out and issued a veto threat on this bipartisan idea. Those were the things that killed this bill, even as it was trying to kind of get off the ground. Now we have a president who doesn't seem to be able to agree to anything that the Senate can pass. And we're in a very difficult situation on this issue, which, again, most Americans agree on.
A lot of calls on this point. Let's go to David in Clearwater, Florida. Hi, David.
Hi, Jane. The Congress should act as the Congress and go ahead and pass what they're going to pass. And if the president vetoes it, he vetoes it. And we'll take our cue from that. But as far as immigration goes, and the president saying this MS-16 is this terrible, terrible thing. Everything they talked about, everything you've talked about on the air, every report that we've had says that they're breaking every law that you can think of, every criminal law. Why don't the police arrest them and put them in jail?
David, thank you. One definite point on this. Lisa, politicians on either side, whether you're talking about David, whether you're David's point or others, I mean, there are powerful interests when it comes to this point, when it comes to immigration. What sets them at odds here?
Well, I think there are... there is a sense, the Republican Party, for a long time, they are worried about security. They're also worried about, there is also a growing, has been a very strong growing movement among Republicans in the last 2 years, not just about illegal immigration, but about legal immigration, and that needs to be limited. I think we are at a time where we are at historical highs for the percentage of immigrants in this country, and we often see a backlash against immigrants at a time like this. That's what we're seeing. We're seeing concerns about identity, especially from Republicans, from Democrats. You see the opposite. You see the argument that we are an immigrant nation, that is our identity. And so then you're getting into a very deep philosophical discussion here. But what happens is there is a lot of money on both sides, making it a political war. And as we saw yesterday, Tom Cotton threatened, he said, anyone who votes against this, the president's bill, you know, is putting their electoral life on the line, saying, you know, we're going to come after you, including Republicans. So to this very difficult American debate, immigration has always been very difficult for any Congress. We're adding a new level of vitriol and money in a political war that has made it even more difficult.
Jack Beatty, President Trump tweeted this morning, cannot believe how badly DACA recipients have been treated by the Democrats, totally abandoned. Republicans are still working hard, end quote. So DACA will expire, Jack Beatty, on March 5th. The fate of these dreamers hanging in the balance. What happens to them? What do you see?
Well, and because of the president's action, I mean, starting in August, he said the clock is running and this program is going to expire in March. And so he blames the Democrats for something that effectively he chose to do. That's a nifty Trumpian trick. And, you know, will we see these people being young people who've never lived outside this country being rounded up and deported? We're already hearing stories of long resident immigrants from various places being plucked out and sent home. And as that becomes a sort of tattoo of news, we're going to hear that every night. What effect is that going to have on the American conscience? You know, I really think the president and his advisor, Stephen Miller, who was the scourge of Santa Monica High School on the issue of Hispanic students in just yesterday, that they don't want a settlement of this because it keeps alive the rancor of a portion of their base, the sense that Lisa spoke to it, that American identity is browning, and that somehow this is a threat to the status and identity and privilege of the white majority, and that this feeling is especially acute among, you know, white working class voters who to this cultural fear add an economic fear. My God, my job is in peril. And I think that passion, that nativist passion, is something the White House wants to keep alive.
Here's Jason in Queenstown, Maryland. Hello, Jason.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Wonderful. So I listen to you guys all the time, and I'm listening to what everyone has to say, and we all have valid points. Everyone's scared and angry right now. My thing is, why does it have to be a Democrat and Republican thing? When it comes to this immigration issue, why does it have to be Democrats want people here or want to help DACA and Republicans don't? Why can't we come together as Americans and realize that we got to bend a little on each side? With gun control, guess what? But either it's Democrats, it's a gun issue, or it's Republicans, it's a mental issue. Well, here's the thought. Kids are dying. Why don't we put our differences aside and come together as Americans instead of Democrats and Republicans and bend a little on each way? Because I'll tell you this much, I would definitely be able to sway a little bit on my gun control and mental health issues if it would mean keeping people alive. The same with immigration. We've got a president whose wife is an immigrant, yet he's telling all of us that immigrants shouldn't be here. It's beyond me.
Jason, thank you. Lisa Desjardins, we thought we had a bipartisan agreement on immigration,
right?
Didn't we?
Right. And, you know, there is this kind of constant scratching and clawing at a bipartisan middle, especially in the Senate. And that was not enough, as we saw this week. I'm glad that Jason brought this up, because I think on immigration, I do want to make it clear, in a way, this is a fight within the Republican Party, because there are Republicans, we saw many of them, eight of them sponsoring this bipartisan bill, who believe that Republicans are very pro-immigrant. And they are, you know, Lindsey Graham is someone who has come out in front of saying, we want Dreamers, we want them to have a, you know, path to citizenship. And he's even sponsored bills which would allow legalization for most people who are here illegally right now. So this is a battle within the Republican Party as much as it is between the parties.
Let's move on now. This week, the director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, warned U.S. lawmakers that Russia is already meddling in the 2018 elections. His words, the U.S. is under attack. Here he is testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee on Tuesday, saying the nation should be aware that Russia is likely to continue interfering in our elections.
We need to inform the American public that this is real, that this is going to be happen, and the resilience needed for us to stand up and say we're not going to allow some Russian to tell us how to vote, how we ought to run our country.
Michael Crowley, jump back in here. The U.S. is under attack. Sounds pretty strong.
It is really strong, and it's an amazing statement, made all the more amazing by the fact that it's not clear that the President of the United States agrees. These intelligence officials suggested that Trump is aware of the situation and has, in kind of broad strokes, said that, I believe CIA Director Mike Pompeo said, you know, Trump has made clear that his duty, that Pompeo's duty is to defend the United States from, you know, all external hostile actors, and that includes Russia. But it's no one testified, including the FBI director, that Trump has given any sort of specific marching orders or edict that he takes this very seriously and he wants to see a clear and coordinated response. There seems to be no leadership coming from the top down. As listeners probably recall, Trump has repeatedly suggested that it's not even entirely clear that Russia did interfere in the 2016 election. He has sort of grudgingly said as much a couple of times, only to quickly walk it back. We continue, by the way, to hear senior administration officials, most recently just this week, Vice President Mike Pence, suggest that the intelligence community concluded firmly that the Russian election interference had no effect on the outcome of the 2016 election. That is not accurate. Former National Intelligence Director James Clapper took Vice President Pence to task in an NPR interview a day or so ago on this point. The important thing to understand is that the 2016 Russian interference did not alter the ballot counts. The Russians didn't go in and change the numbers in the voting machines to change the numerical outcome. But there's a lot of reason to think, and Clapper himself said he does believe, that it's quite likely that the Russian interference, in terms of the fake news, the bots, the hacking of Democratic emails, including from the Clinton campaign, affected individual voter decisions. So it's entirely possible in a close election that the Russians did affect the outcome. And I'll just say, and the last point I'll make, this question of, you know, we're sort of using the metaphor here of an attack and thinking in military terms, I think it's instructive. Imagine if George W. Bush had, after September 11th, 2001, raised questions about who was behind the attacks, whether they had even really happened, and essentially took no leadership in ordering the cockpit doors on passenger jets be hardened, took no interest in beefing up airport security or increasing border security in the United States. I mean, it would be a completely astonishing thing that would be universally condemned as a shocking dereliction of duty that left the country in grave danger. Yet I don't think it's an inapt analogy for what is happening here with our president in this country. And I think people are really still trying to wrap their minds around it. It's actually quite hard to believe.
Marshall is in McAllen, Texas. Hi, Marshall. You're on the air.
Howdy, Dane. How are you?
Well, thank you. Go ahead, sir.
So my comment on Russia is mostly, I'm not sure you can convince people that don't believe, and here's why. There were two articles printed, one in August and one in September of 2016, one reported by AP and one reported by Reuters. And it said that the Russian intelligence service was hacking our election. They were trying to get into the mainframe. Now, the two most widely respected wire services, the place you go get information from if you're a reporter, where you start your research, if they're telling us that and citizens don't believe it or don't read it, you can't very well put a gun to their head and say, you must read.
Marshall, thank you. Lisa Desjardins, do you think a lot of Americans are still in, denial over this?
I do think that a lot of Americans are. And I also think, to Michael's point, that because we haven't seen a full-throttled look at this from the current administration, we really don't have our hands yet around everything that's happening from Russia and with Russia. You know, there was an article in the LA Times this week that pointed out that we went at a conference last year, that 25 hackers tried to – or hackers tried to break into 30 different voting systems used around the country. And they were able to break into every single one. This was just last year. And in some cases, some of those machines were compromised without any trace of evidence. So to some degree, you know, we don't really know what maybe was even attempted in 2016. We certainly know that machines have not been upgraded for 2018.
Jack Beatty, wrap us up in 10 seconds on this point.
Well, the New York Times says the president's not taking this seriously is violating his oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And they conjecture maybe he wants his friends in Russia to interfere in the 2018 election.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. In other news this week, President and Mrs. Obama are now on permanent display at the National Portrait Gallery. President Obama said he jokingly admitted that he asked artist Kehinde Wiley to make some changes to his appearance.
I tried to negotiate less gray hair. And Kehinde's artistic integrity would not allow him to do what I asked. I tried to negotiate smaller ears. Struck out on that as well.
At the stroke of midnight on Valentine's Day, dozens of couples said their I do's on the steps of Bexar County Courthouse in San Antonio, Texas.
Rich or poor, in sickness and in health. To love and to cherish, till death do us part.
And on Sunday, figure skater Mirai Nagasu became the first American woman to land a triple axel at an Olympic Games.
So as she's skating into it now, she has to keep the speed. She can't second guess. She has to go right up into it. Yes!
Beautiful. Michael Crowley, let's jump back in to Steve Bannon. We were talking about Dan Coats before the break, testifying this week. Steve Bannon was also on Capitol Hill, interviewed by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, met behind closed doors, also with the House Intelligence Committee. Tell us about that and where we are in the Russia investigation.
Yeah, well, Bannon, of course, knows quite a lot about what happened in the Trump campaign transition and White House until he was ousted last summer as the president's chief political strategist. He, interestingly, had not really been a much discussed figure in the Russia investigation until several weeks ago. And I think really people focused on him after Michael Wolff's kind of sensational book, Fire and Fury, quoted him expressing strong opinions about some of the Trump campaign contacts with Russia. I believe Bannon suggested in that book that he believed that Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Russian lawyer who was offering dirt on Hillary Clinton in the summer of 2016 was tantamount to treason. And Bannon has also said that he thought Trump's decision to fire FBI Director James Comey was one of the dumbest political moves in modern history. I think he said that on 60 Minutes. So clearly had some interesting opinions and was around for a lot of this. We have known for a while that Special Counsel Robert Mueller wanted to talk to him and discovered after the fact that he had spent, according to NBC News, 20 hours talking with the special counsel's team. And meanwhile, a saga continues to play out with the House Intelligence Committee, which is running a parallel investigation, as is the Senate Intelligence Committee and Senate Judiciary Committee, into Russian election interference. Bannon had appeared before the House Intelligence Committee, which has been really kind of riven by intense partisanship. But on this subject, Bannon has united Democrats and Republicans. He appeared before the committee a month ago, essentially refused to answer the vast majority of their questions, said he would not talk about the transition or his time during the White House, and was invoking executive privilege, which is a principle that presidents can invoke to shield their private conversations from other branches of government, in this case, the legislative branch. But members of Congress believe that it's invalid for Bannon to be invoking that privilege on the president's behalf. And long story short, think that he is basically stonewalling them. So they immediately subpoenaed Bannon. There were a couple of canceled appearances. He finally came back again yesterday, this time presented a list of 25 questions he was willing to answer, which Democrats on the committee, and I believe some Republicans agree, said were essentially scripted by the White House. The White House has been negotiating with the House Intelligence Committee for some time now the ground rules of Bannon's testimony. Again, going back to this question of, is there some presidential privilege that the White House can exert that would cover what Bannon is able and willing to discuss about what he saw during the Trump transition and in the Trump White House? So to boil this all down, on this House Intelligence Committee, which has been furiously fighting for weeks, where listeners will be familiar with these dueling memos about the FISA warrant on Carter Page, everyone's very angry at each other. They're actually unified in their great frustration with Bannon and the Trump White House that they're not able to ask him all sorts of questions that they want that are kind of free-ranging. They've been given essentially a couple dozen yes or no, highly limited questions that some members believe are kind of designed to mislead and obfuscate. So the question now is, will they actually hold Bannon in contempt, and will this drama escalate? But there is no sign that Bannon has limited his testimony to Mueller. So it does seem that whatever is in his head is getting to authorities with significant power to advance and act on that information, but as far as the House goes, it is the subject of a very tense struggle right now.
Jack Beatty, pick up on that: the scripted questions, the evoking of executive privilege by Steve Bannon. Your thoughts?
Well, he seems to be just defying Congress, and if Congress has any dignity on this question, they will subpoena him and require his testimony. Meanwhile, though, CNN is reporting that yet another principal in this investigation, Rick Gates, who was the assistant to Paul Manafort and was, in effect, the assistant campaign manager of the Trump campaign for a period, that Rick Gates is flipping, that he's going to cooperate with the Mueller investigation and testify against Mr. Manafort, presumably, and perhaps beyond Mr. Manafort. That is only CNN reported it that I've seen, but if that is so, that's a very serious matter for the Trump campaign because of Gates's propinquity to Manafort and the campaign. And we learned today that even after the election, Gates was involved in the inaugural planning and received $100,000 for his pains.
Lisa Desjardins, what about the Gates testimony?
I think in this whole matter, we have to be very careful because I think the CNN story is based on, I think, one anonymous source. And I think we've seen a lot of the reporting on this, you know, some better than others. I think it's probably good to wait out on that story and see what happens. We know that Gates's lawyers have two of his original lawyers, you know, asked to be removed from the case. He's focusing on a different lawyer. I just think that this is a difficult story, and it has been for a long time, because the one investigation that I think we hope to hear the most from. The Senate investigation has been the most bipartisan, and they're not coming out with their results yet for good reasons. They're still doing their own interviews, and it's of course made many people impatient to get to the bottom of this, including the president. But I think I don't know. I just want to stress patience, and anonymous sourcing on some of this makes me nervous. I think we just have to be careful.
There was other testimony this week on Capitol Hill before the Senate Intelligence Committee on Tuesday. FBI Director Chris Wray said the Bureau's background probe of Rob Porter was done months ago, nearly 7 months before White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter was forced to resign over allegations of domestic violence from two ex-wives. Here's that.
The FBI submitted a partial report on the investigation in question in March, and then a completed background investigation in late July.
So, Michael Crowley, what about the back and forth here, the who, what, who knew what, when sort of conversation that we've been seeing on this matter this week?
Well, we're still trying to figure out who knew what, when. I mean, that's the kind of bottom line here. And, you know, it looked as though the White House was pointing the finger at the FBI to some degree, and Wray turned around in a very public forum and in a very clear way, kind of pointed it right back, or at least said, you know, this is not on me. And the White House has really been done an inept job of explaining what happened here. And it's really shocking when it comes to allegations of this severity that there wouldn't be a clearer reckoning. It definitely suggests that the truth reflects very poorly on senior people in the West Wing. There is anger. There has been reporting about anger within the White House staff at the Chief of Staff, John Kelly. There have been some suggestions anonymously sourced that Kelly himself has not been forthcoming to other people in the White House. There were even some intimations that Kelly's job might be in danger, although it seems as though that storm maybe has passed. But, you know, I think that Peter Baker in The New York Times a day or so ago, you know, put his finger on it when he said, I mean, there's so much that's different about the way this White House does business. But one clear example here is their failure to understand one of the key lessons in Washington politics, which is that you really have to rip the Band-Aid off when you've bungled something. Don't muddle through it for days and days and days and extend the problem. You know, come clean as best you can. And of course, no White House has ever perfected the art of doing that, and White Houses commit all sorts of self-inflicted wounds. But this really seems to be, you know, they've really made a hash of this one in an unusual way, and just been unable to get a message out on almost any other subject now for the good part of a week. And just not to obscure the underlying gravity of the charges, the seriousness of what Rob Porter is accused of, that's what's really important here. But in addition to that, really political ineptitude at a minimum, and maybe dishonesty that's very troubling.
In fact, a week after allegations against the former White House aide rocked the White House, President Trump condemned domestic violence. Here he is.
I am totally opposed to domestic violence of any kind. Everyone knows that, and it almost wouldn't even have to be said. So now you hear it, but you all know it.
Here's Bree in Belfast, Maine. Hi, Bree.
Hi, Jane. I just want to say you're doing a great job here.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Go ahead.
I also want to say that I think we're going to miss an opportunity if we don't take the time to draw a connection between the behavior of the president on this topic, the behavior of Rob Porter, and in its context of the wider Time's Up and Me Too movement and what's happened in Florida. I see it all as a symptom of the same disease of rampant toxic masculinity. And I think if we connect all those things together, we can harness the power of the gun control movement and of the Time's Up and Me Too movements. And maybe we can make a change about the heart of this problem.
Bree, thank you very much for the call. We just have a few minutes left here, so I want to move on to some international stories that happened this week. On Wednesday in Tel Aviv, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu attacked a police recommendation calling for his indictment based on their findings that he had accepted nearly $300,000 in bribes.
After I read the recommendation report, I can say it is biased, extreme, full of holes, like Swiss cheese.
Like Swiss cheese, Michael Crowley, yes or no, up or down? And will he be able to survive this, Benjamin Netanyahu?
I think it's unlikely. I spoke to some people who are in Israeli politics just a couple of days ago who know quite a lot about what's going on. They have no brief against Netanyahu. Their view of it was very grim, and it was more a sense of not whether he can survive, but how long he can drag it out and what effect it might have on Israeli politics. And you know, of course, there are implications here for the relationship with the United States. Donald Trump would like to kind of restart the peace process, such as it is, between Israel and the Palestinians. He has a couple of advisors, including his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who have been traveling to the region and trying to cook up a proposal that will get things kickstarted again. And it's unclear how Netanyahu's plight might affect those prospects. You know, it's also interesting to hear the way Netanyahu is reacting. I think that you hear some echoes of the way Donald Trump has gone after Robert Mueller, and Trump's allies have gone after the federal probes into Trump's Russia connections, really undermining the legitimacy and credibility and motives of his accusers and trying to dig in for a sort of all-out political war. But my sense from what I've been reading and hearing is that Netanyahu is unlikely to survive it, although he might be able to hold on for several months. And possibly if he can sort of wage a hard political fight, get political leverage to sort of bargain down his legal jeopardy. That's sort of the best he can hope for right now.
From Israel to South Africa, South African President Jacob Zuma said he accepts the ruling of the African National Congress instructing him to leave office this week.
I do not fear exiting political office. However, I have only asked my party to articulate my transgressions, and the reason for its immediate instruction that I vacate office.
Michael Crowley, South African President Zuma, his presidency has been marred by scandal and corruption and certainly mismanagement for many years. 9 years, I think, he's been in office, correct?
Yeah, 9 years. And it's a sad story. South Africa could be really the jewel, the continent, the leader of the continent politically, economically. When Zuma took office, the prospects for the South African economy were bright. And there was hope that, it could be a model for a continent that has struggled with, its political development, and there's rampant corruption. And unfortunately, Zuma fell prey to those forces that have that have caused so much disappointment across the continent for decades now. His term was overshadowed by corruption almost from the beginning. And the South African economy is now in something of a mess. It's been a great disappointment. The country has a long road back. So very, very disappointing for South Africa and the African continent as a whole.
We got to a lot this hour, and I really appreciate you being with us. Michael Crowley, Senior Foreign Affairs Correspondent for Politico. Always nice to have you, Michael. Thank you.
Thanks. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Lisa Desjardins, Correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Great to have you, Lisa. Thanks.
You're welcome. It's an honor.
And Jack Beatty. Have a good weekend, Jack.
Thank you very much, Jen.
Continue the conversation, listeners. Get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.